from WBUR in Boston and NPR, I'm Jennifer Glass, and this is On Point. China has announced duties of up to 25% on 128 U.S. food imports starting today. It's China's response to President Trump's tariffs on steel and aluminum and on Chinese goods yet to be named. For the past decade and a half, while the U.S. has played the world's policeman, China has been building and investing around the globe, from Southeast Asia to South America. And last week, President Xi Jinping met with North Korea's Kim Jong-un to talk denuclearization before Kim's scheduled meetings with South Korea and President Trump. China is increasingly showing its economic and political might. This hour on Point, The View from Beijing, What China Wants from the World. You can join us on air or online. What do you make of China's actions? Is a trade war looming? Has it begun? Should the U.S. be concerned about a rising China, or challenged, or happy to share the burden of troubles around the globe? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now from Beijing, China, is Anthony Kuhn, NPR's Beijing correspondent. Anthony Kuhn, welcome to On Point.
Thanks very much, Jennifer. Nice to join you.
Good to talk to you. Anthony, let's start with those tariffs. What is it all about? What do they affect?
Okay, these are tariffs that China announced in retaliation for U.S. tariffs on Chinese steel and aluminum, which the U.S. says China was dumping. This is actually not the main beef, which could escalate into a trade war. This is a much more this is a much smaller issue. The Trump administration has more than $50 billion worth of tariffs planned, and that is for what the U.S. says is stealing U.S. intellectual property or forcing U.S. companies to hand it over. But this is about steel and aluminum, and the Chinese tariffs, which are on things like fruits and wine and pork, are only worth about $3 billion. So that's really not much, and it gives lots of room for negotiation for either side to back down later. From this end, I have to say there's not a lot of hyperventilating going on. China could amp up the nationalist rhetoric, say how the U.S. is bullying it. It's not doing that. I think China sees this basically as a money matter, and money matters are by nature negotiable. It's not a sovereignty matter like Taiwan. They're much more upset about the Taiwan Travel Act, which the Trump administration really recently signed, and right after that sent a high-level State Department official to Taiwan. I think the bottom line is that China economically feels fairly confident because it is now not just the world's largest exporter, it's also the world's largest consumer, as opposed to, say, 10 years ago during the world financial crisis. Now they're much less reliant on their exports, and I think they feel they can take a certain hit to external demand and rely on their domestic market to sort of muddle through it.
And this doesn't come as a surprise, does it, Anthony? In March 22nd interview, the same day that Trump signed those sanctions on steel and aluminum, that interview with Chinese state TV posted on the embassy's Facebook page, China's ambassador to the U.S., Sui Tan Kai, warned President Trump that the U.S. wants to play tough on tariffs, so will China.
Let me assure those people who intend to fight a trade war, we will certainly fight back. We will retaliate. If people want to play tough, we will play tough with them and see who will last longer.
And this, Anthony, certainly does seem to show that China is willing to play tough. Is this part of its new stance toward the world?
Well, it said very clearly that, you know, it's not trying to pick a fight, but if there is one, it's not going to back down. And, you know, they have not used their big guns yet. If they really wanted to hit the U.S., they could start hitting the really big ticket items like airplanes from Boeing, like imports of U.S. grains such as wheat, sorghum, and soybeans. And this is still an early phase of this brewing trade war. And I think China sees that it could go any way. And I don't think, you know, that it's thinking about really modifying its behavior that much. If you look at what the The major trade war is about. What the U.S. measures are aimed at is China's industrial policy. It's got something called Made in China 2025. China wants to move up the value chain, really dominate emerging technologies like blockchain and AI and quantum and self-driving vehicles. And it wants to make those indigenous. It wants to control these technologies itself and, to a certain extent, force foreign companies out of the market. But that's a long way down the road. There's no telling that they can do this at all.
And last month, China's Communist Party abolished term limits for the president. So Xi could be president for life. Does that help him? What will that mean for China's policy?
Well, it's not like it was completely unexpected, but when this was announced that he had gotten rid of term limits on the presidency, it was certainly a shock to, I think, a lot of people. This is a major problem for China, this problem of succession of the leadership. And for the past more than 20 years, you've had a somewhat regularized system where people retired after two terms in office. And I think this shows that basically these reforms were very shallowly rooted and very easy for Xi Jinping to sweep away. Now, the Communist Party says, you know, we're not going back to lifelong tenure. We've had orderly power successions for decades, and it's going to stay that way. But basically, nobody knows how long Xi Jinping could stay on, 15, 20, 25 years. We just have no idea. And if you are in China and you are, say, a human rights activist, you are a civil society proponent, you are an investigative journalist, you may not be seeing a very bright future in the coming years. So I think, you know, Xi Jinping probably feels he's freed up to pursue this grand agenda he's got of a national renaissance and putting the Communist Party in charge of just about everything. I think one of the major concerns is that he might make some sort of risky bid for the history books, like, for example, at some point putting some military moves on Taiwan. Nobody knows about that. But for sure, I think his move raises the stakes. Then again, you know, having taken all this responsibility, taking on all this power, it gives him a lot more responsibility to face. So if he breaks it, he owns it.
But it does also give him a lot of latitude because, as you say, he could be in power for the next 15, 20, 25 years. Talk a little bit, Anthony, about those grand visions he has, about those grand plans he has, not just the Made in China 2025. He must have other visions for China as well.
Sure. This idea of a national renaissance is to put China at the center of the world stage where it's used to being for much of history. He wants not only for China to be a great power by the middle of this century, but a strong power, a powerful power. And as I said, he wants to put the Communist Party in charge of everything at home. And it's been sort of like sucking up the functions of the Chinese government into the Communist Party. He wants a good external environment for these changes. He wants China linked to all the neighboring countries to take in energy and export goods. He wants military and strategic depth so that China can see adversaries coming at it from a long way away and so that it can project power outwards. And I think also China very much wants acceptance of its rise, which means at the very least as little criticism of it as possible.
And he's made no secret of that, Anthony. On March 20th, during his closing address to the Nationalist People's Congress, Xi Jinping reasserted the Communist Party's supremacy over the country, and he said that socialism is the way to make China great again. He says history has proven and will continue to prove that only socialism can save China, and only by upholding and developing socialism within Chinese characteristics can we achieve the great national rejuvenation. That great national rejuvenation, something he aspires to, something you talked about, but perhaps a little bit of a threat to the rest of the world?
Well, after this, he said, you know, we're not trying to export our model onto anyone. We're not trying to coerce anyone into anything. But I think he is saying that, you know, China provides a path. He also said in the same speech, you know, China can provide a path or a model for countries who want to go a different way than the Western democracies or something. And also, if you just look at, you know, China's growing influence in Southeast Asia, which I'm sure you'll get into shortly, you can see that when countries get very much in debt into China, that China gives them a lot of money and a lot of investment, it expects these countries to dance to their tune politically on issues such as the South China Sea, such as human rights. So there's certainly people who feel that China is trying to export its model.
And also briefly, Anthony, last week Xi met with the North Korean leader, Kim Jong-un. What was the message there?
Well, it was a very important moment. You know, for the past 7 years since Kim Jong-un came to power in 2011, ties have been pretty frosty between China and North Korea. There's a basic disagreement. China just did not agree with, you know, North Korea having nukes. And because of this, China would not let Kim Jong-un visit. And it's always China that North Korea, Korean leaders go to visit first. So this visit was, although it was labeled unofficial, there was full of pomp and motorcades and secrecy. It wasn't announced until the visit was over and Kim had left. And also some very, very retro communist jargon, this language of solidarity between communist parties, you know, references to the fact that they fought together in the Korean War. And I think the messages here for other countries are first that, you know, you can forget about driving a wedge between us. We're the traditional allies. And also, finally, you know, the U.S. and North Korea can talk all they want, but if decisions are going to get made about the future of the Asian region, China needs to be at the table.
Anthony Kuhn, stay with us. We're discussing China as it flexes its political and financial clout around the globe. You can join the conversation. What do you make of President Xi Jinping's meeting with Kim Jong-un? Are there lessons for President Trump as he prepares to meet with North Korea's leader? I'm Jennifer Glass, and this is On Point.
I'm Linda Holmes. There's more stuff to watch these days than you can ever get to. That's why we make Pop Culture Happy Hour. Twice a week, we give you the lowdown on what's worth your time and what's not. Find Pop Culture Happy Hour on the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Jennifer Glass. We're taking a look at the world through China's eyes as it tries to project its influence and protect its interests. You can join the conversation. What do you make of the power consolidation by President Xi Jinping? Removing presidential term limits, having his political thought mentioned in the same breath as Chairman Mao, Deng Xiaoping. Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm talking with NPR's Beijing correspondent Anthony Kuhn, and joining us now from Washington is Derek Scissors. He's a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, where he focuses on the Chinese economy. He is the author of the China Global Investment Tracker, and you can find a link to it at our website, onpointradio.org. He's also the chief economist of China Beige Book, which tracks the country's economic data. Derek Scissors, welcome to On Point.
Thanks for having me.
And also with us from Washington is Yun Sun, the co-director of the East Asia Program and director of the China Program at the Stimson Center. She's an expert on Chinese foreign policy, China's relations with neighboring countries and authoritarian regimes, and U.S.-China relations. Yun Sun, welcome to On Point.
Thank you for having me.
Great. Before we go to both of you, I want to talk a little bit about what President Xi Jinping said in his New Year's address. He said the country is taking more responsibility around the globe and will be a strong world power. He says China will staunchly safeguard the authority and status of the United Nations and actively fulfill its due responsibility and duty in international affairs. China will honor its promises in countering global climate change and actively push forward the common construction of the Belt and Road. China will act as a builder of world peace, a contributor to global development, and an upholder of the international order. Well, a lot to take in there. Let's start with you, Derek. What do you think about that? Is he speaking the truth?
Well, I do think if we're thinking about this from the Chinese perspective, the Chinese don't come to the world with nothing to offer. I'll stick to economics, is what I know. They are a major market for many countries' imports. There is no substitute for China for some of these countries. In the Belt and Road, China provides technological and engineering expertise.
Sorry, let me just interrupt so that our listeners can get up to speed. The Belt and Road is that $46 billion initiative that's the key of Xi Jinping's foreign policy to build trade and infrastructure networks around the world, including upgrading or developing roads and ports in South America, in Africa, in Asia, Southeast Asia.
Yes, that's all right, except for the figure with $46 billion. It's already considerably higher than that, and there's some dispute about how high it can go. But let's say $500 billion for now, and then there are people who believe it will become much larger. But the goal is to do everything you just said. So, for example, on the Belt and Road, the Chinese don't come and say, "Here, borrow a lot of money and waste it, then be indebted to us, and we tell you what to do." You know, as some caricatures would say, they say, "Do you need a highway between your major cities? Do you need a power plant? Do you need to spread your telecom grid to the rest of the country? We will do this well and cheaper than Western companies or Japanese companies or Korean companies. You don't need to go to the World Bank. We won't impose conditions." So China starts by coming to the world with something to offer. And if we're looking at it from their perspective, we should understand that. There are, of course, also things that they ask of the world that aren't as savory.
And Yun Sun, is this a good policy, a bad policy?
It depends on which angle we're speaking of. If you're a Chinese financier, your Chinese bank who has been told by the Chinese government to provide loans to projects that you don't know whether will be profitable in the future, whether it's bankable or commercially viable, you don't know whether the recipient countries will be able to repay your loans. But you treat these instructions, which is directions, as a political task that the central government gives you. But on the other hand, when the central government also tells the bank that we also want you to be considerate about the feasibility of these commercial projects, we're not just giving money to these recipient countries, we're do not want to lose our money. I think it does put the state-owned banks in a very difficult position. But if you are a Chinese SOE, a state-owned enterprise, and you are hoping to carve up a bigger share of the pie, it's basically a feast of Chinese government's capital putting into foreign markets, and Chinese companies in this equation are the ones who are supposed to get the contracts, for example, for the infrastructure projects. If you are going to build a road in, say, Kazakhstan, then Chinese companies are supposed to get the contract. So from the SOE's perspective, I think the picture is much more prosperous and much more promising.
So good for China. We're going to go to the phones now. Carl is calling from Nashville, Tennessee. Carl, you're on the air.
Well, you have to go to the root of this, and unfortunately, this is what happened when a country as sophisticated economic system as the United States elects an incompetent man in Donald Trump. And you have to look at it objectively and from China's point of view. If you have someone that puts in a horrible policy as tariffs, what are you going to do? You're going to react. And now it's our turn. What are we going to do? Are we going to react? Of course we are, because we have incompetence at leadership in Washington right now in the form of Donald Trump. And this is what's going to happen. It's just going to escalate because, unfortunately, November of 2016, we did what we did to our country, and there's no turning back. We just have to go forward, I guess.
Thank you, Carl. Carl's saying Trump's tariffs were bad policy, and China, what it's done, it's retaliation today, not surprising. Yun, let's go to you first.
Well, again, I think from the Chinese perspective, the question for the Chinese, what the Chinese are asking, is that does this tariff suggest a negotiation strategy, meaning that President Trump is trying to use this to get a better deal, to get a better negotiation out of China, or this is essentially a declaration of an American hostile policy towards China? And like Tony mentioned earlier, the issue of Taiwan Travel Act is even worse than the tariff. So I think so far, the Chinese are treating that as a negotiation strategy. that Trump is not aiming for a trade war, although he does not have a problem risking a trade war, or to use the strategy of a brinkmanship to push the Chinese, to make sure the Chinese understand his resolve. And therefore, the Chinese hopefully will negotiate a better deal for the Americans. The Chinese also believe that by levying this special tariff on Chinese products, Trump is also fulfilling his campaign promises. So there's a domestic political aspect to it, at least in the Chinese perspective, that Trump is doing this not because of China, but because of the promises he made about China during his campaign, during his presidential campaign. So that further suggests to the Chinese that, again, this might be negotiable.
And Derek, did China make this move today to maybe send a shot across the bow of Washington? Is it asserting its power? Is it, as you say, not as dependent on exports as it was before? And will it have a big effect? Or is this just another negotiating tactic by the Chinese?
I think it's a negotiating tactic. I mean, people should realize that in our total trade with China, $3 billion obviously sounds like a lot of money, is an afterthought. What the Chinese are doing is two things. One is the aggressive side, which is they're able to implement these tariffs very quickly after their announcement. The U.S. has announced $50 to $60 billion worth of goods to be tariffed, but we still haven't finalized that list. It's taking us a long time. The Chinese say $3 billion, which is much less. It happens right away. So one thing they're signaling is we can move quickly if you make us. I tend to disagree with those people who think China isn't as dependent on U.S. trade. They're thinking about economic growth. That's not the dependence. China in recent years has seen a lot of money leave the country. The way it tries to control that money, but the way it has offset the loss of money with money leaving the country is to bring a lot of money in. And the biggest source of bringing money into the country is the trade surplus with the United States. So the threat to China is not a few trade actions back and forth. That's not going to matter to its growth. But a real trade war with the U.S. that threatens all those dollars coming to China, that's a risk that the Chinese face that the United States doesn't face. So the second thing the Chinese are doing when they pick $3 billion is to say, look, it's $3 billion. We both know that sounds like more money than it is in the context of our trade relationship. We're being quick, but we're also being very modest in our action. We're not looking for a trade war.
So China kind of moderating what it's doing right now, but letting the United States know it's going to push back. Let's talk a little bit about China's ambitious future economic policies. We're going to go to Kurt calling from Ames, Iowa. Kurt, thanks for calling in to On Point.
Hi, Jennifer. This is Kurt. I want to make a comment, actually it's going to be a question and then ask your guest to comment on it. I'm wondering if this China 2025, where they're pouring tens of billions of dollars into artificial intelligence, self-driving cars, et cetera, if that, and at the same time, they're stealing intellectual property of that building in Shanghai where they hack into companies in the U.S. and steal intellectual property, and they're forcing American companies to turn over their technology to Chinese companies if the American company wants to market in China. I'm wondering if all of this is a security threat for the next 50 years for the United States.
Thanks, Kurt. That's a great question. Derek, I'm going to let you take that. You're our China economics guy.
Yeah, I mean, I understand the first caller, not Kurt, objecting to some of the Trump administration's policies. I have some objections as well. On this, however, I largely agree with the administration. China has a very explicit policy of acquiring advanced technology. They've stated it as an extremely high priority. There is a clear track record of the Chinese coercing American firms into transferring technology, of stealing it. So we know China wants more advanced technology, which is understandable because it says so. We also have the evidence in front of us that they're willing to use illegal or borderline illegal tools to acquire that technology. So there's an economic problem here, which is American innovation is being stolen or otherwise acquired by China. There's also a future security problem. Now, you know, the Chinese will say, look, we're not looking to invade the United States or anything along those lines. So we have to realize the security problem goes both ways. But from the D.C. perspective, from the perspective of the U.S. national government, we could end up in a conflict with China, say, over Taiwan or over the South China Sea. And this technology that they're trying to develop on their own and take from others, certainly including the United States, could be used against us in that conflict. So in the short term, we have an economic problem with Chinese policy. In the long term, we may have a security problem.
Anthony Kuhn, in Beijing, I want to bring you in. Derek was talking about Washington's perspective. What about Beijing's perspective on all of this?
Well, on one hand, you know, what they're trying to do is just like any other country. They started out making inexpensive products like toys and shoes and stuff like that. And they want to move up the value chain. They want to avoid falling into the so-called middle income trap. But as Derek pointed out, the U.S. problem with this is how they get the technology, and also how they treat foreign firms. Now, what China is saying is we're going to solve all these problems by opening up and reforming even more. And all you foreign companies are going to make a lot of money that way. And they sort of have a point in that, you know, the process of acquiring this technology is going to make some American firms very wealthy. In the end, they may end up getting squeezed out of the market as their Chinese competitors get an edge on them. But in the short term, U.S. companies are a little bit conflicted. They're saying, you know, the Chinese government is treating us so unfairly. They're taking our property. They're forcing us into these joint ventures. But a lot of U.S. firms are still profiting very handsomely from the Chinese market.
So are U.S. firms taking a shorter-term outlook while China can wait it out a little bit more?
Well, you know, I think there is a consensus about this. These firms used to be one of the most stabilizing voices in the U.S.-China relationship. And also through the sort of pro-business wing of the Republican Party, they often called for more moderate policies towards China. But they're really upset now, as China needs less foreign investment. They're getting fewer and fewer preferential policies, and it's getting harder and harder for them to make money. And their Chinese competitors are really putting the squeeze on them. So they are the ones who are really calling on the U.S. government to get tough on China trade-wise.
So things are changing. Let's go to Rod, who's calling from Davenport, Iowa. Rod, you're on Point.
Hi, Jennifer. I was just thinking back. I was listening to your discussion here about the communism of China, and then but maybe think back to the Cold War when our own capitalism seemed to have trumped or have succeeded over the communism and its inability to foster innovation and motivation from people. Do you think, has there been a change in the fundamental type of communism that China currently has? And can it get the best of both worlds? Can it foster innovation and the type of results that a free economy offers?
Thanks, Rod. Rod's asking whether the Chinese model of communism has changed. Yun Sun, I'd like you to take that.
Well, first of all, whether China is still a communist country is subject to debate. China, well, the ruling party is still called the Chinese Communist Party. But if you look at their economic policies, the capitalist policies, it's still state-controlled capitalism. But to what extent the Chinese Communist Party is striving for the communist ideal, that's very much subject to debate. And most of the Chinese today probably would not agree that China is still a communist country. They will agree that, well, it's our authoritarian state. And in terms of its economic policy, it's certainly pursue a capitalist economy with the state play a very, very large role. But the communist nature of that country is quite questionable. But coming to its foreign policy, whether China is trying to spread its ideology or the China model, so-called the China model or the Beijing consensus, I think that is a bigger question here, because in developing countries, in, for example, Southeast Asia, in Africa, we do see that China promotes what the Chinese call the experiences in terms of economic development and political governance in these countries. And these are usually countries that have suffered from either economic stagnation or political instability. So I think what the Chinese have done is through their own foreign aid projects, through their foreign investment, through their financing, and through their capacity building projects, that they bring the cadre, party cadres and government officials and younger generation leaders from these countries to come to China, for example, for 2 weeks of training program, where the Chinese government will set up training programs to show them how China runs things. For example, how China runs a special economic zone in China, or how the Chinese Department of Propaganda controls the opposition views or shut down opposition views online. So I think those are the indicators of active promotion of the Chinese model, of the Chinese way of doing political and economic policies at home.
NPR's Code Switch tackles race and identity in America with humanity and humor. You'll laugh, you'll learn, you'll get uncomfortable. It's worth it. Find Code Switch on the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Jennifer Glass. We're talking about China, its economic strategy, and its political goals as it becomes an even bigger world player. You can join the conversation. How should the U.S. be responding to all of this? What about the rest of the world? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm talking with NPR's Beijing correspondent Anthony Kuhn, Derek Scissors from the American Enterprise Institute, and Yun Sun from the Stimson Center. We're going to hear first from Eugene, calling from London, Kentucky. Eugene, thanks for calling in.
Thank you. I just want to make a comment. People are trying to judge what is happening with the trade war way too quickly. I mean, we're putting in tariffs and they're putting in tariffs, but people are trying to put Trump down for what he's done already without seeing what the final outcome is going to be. When the Obama administration was actually in office, I lost work as an electrician due to manufacturing construction companies shutting down and not having any work to do here. But since Trump has come into office, manufacturing businesses have picked back up, my construction has picked back up, and my monthly income has actually increased by about $4,000 a month. And with the trade war getting stepping in, I'm already seeing a boost in my income because more companies are starting to build and they're needing more trade skills around.
Eugene,
I think the trade war might actually come out to be good.
Eugene, thanks so much for calling. We're going to go now to Mike from Natick, Massachusetts. Mike?
Thank you. Thank you much. My question is, how do you win a trade war when most of the products we buy are made in China and most of the products, pretty much all the products that Chinese buy are also made in China? As far as of technology problems, aren't most of our high-tech items, if not, maybe designed here in some cases, but mostly not, are produced, assembled in China? Don't they just have a front row seat at stealing technology when they're making the item there or putting it together at least there? So how do you win this war?
Thanks, Mike. Derek, that's something I think you addressed a little bit earlier. China does assemble a lot of things. There's a lot of technology companies that go to China for their cheap labor. How does this affect a possible looming trade war?
Yeah, I think both callers are on to something here, which is if the U.S. wants to change the way we trade and deal economically with China, it's going to take a long time. You don't judge it after a month. And it's going to involve pulling some production out of China, which we are able to do, but it will not be easy and it will not be free. So, one of the things that you have to decide on with a trade war or a serious trade conflict, not the one we have now, but something that would be sustained over a matter of years and really change the relationship is, do you want to pay the price for that? Because we can stop importing those goods from China, which means a lot of production is going to leave China and go elsewhere. But that means the cost for those products is going to rise. The production is located in China because it's cheaper and better to do it in China. So the way you address the technology problem is you just say, we're not going to import these kinds of goods from China anymore. And then the Chinese can't assemble those goods because there's no profit in making them in China if you can't send them to the United States. But that means that there's a cost to American companies who are doing business in China. There's a cost to American consumers. So I think the way to think about U.S. policy towards China is whether we have, and you brought this up in the opening, whether we have the patience to stick with it. Our trade, our economic relationship with China is much too big to have a few tariffs back and forth and to be changed. You mentioned Xi Jinping being in office for 15 to 20 years. He has the time frame to be patient. We need to have consensus on the American side that this is a policy we're going to stick to, or it's not going to work.
Let's go again to the phones. Danielle is calling from Woodward, Iowa.
Hi, Jennifer. Thanks for taking my call. We in Iowa have become a colony of China. They are growing large numbers of pigs here. We have corporate agriculturalists aided and abetted by our former governor, Terry Branstad, who is now the Chinese ambassador. No one cares whether we stop eating pork. It's all going to much of it is going to China, so we end up with horrific water pollution, landscape devastation. You can't walk in the surface waters of Iowa without getting sores on your body. Dogs can't drink the water because their livers will fail. We are a colony of China, and it was promoted by the Iowa Farm Bureau and the former governor of Iowa, Terry Branstad.
Thank you, Danielle, for that. So China having its effect in Iowa. China has made no secret of its expansion, its Belt and Road Initiative, part of President Xi Jinping's very grand plan around the world. In his closing address to the annual gathering of the National People's Congress, Xi Jinping said that he plans to continue expanding, but he told his critics that China isn't a threat to the world. China will by no means seek development, he said, at the expense of other countries. China's development will not pose a threat to any other country, and we will never seek hegemony or engage in expansion. Only those who get used to threatening others will regard everyone else around them as a threat. So comforting words from the Chinese president, but Yun Sun, maybe not everyone sees it that way.
Yes, I think from the Chinese perspective and from Xi Jinping's perspective, he sees that China's foreign policy campaign, the Belt and Road, and everything that's associated with Belt and Road, as China providing a public good, providing future opportunities to other countries. And China is offering these opportunities that otherwise would not be available to some of these countries. And there's some truth to it, like Derek pointed out, that in terms of the Chinese financing, China is funneling money into countries that otherwise would not be able to get funding on the international financial market, either because their domestic politics is not stable enough or because of their investment environment is not sound enough, that foreign investors would not go there. So China, I think there is some truth to it. But on the other hand, I think from the Chinese perspective, to claim that China will never be a threat, well, that's not for China to say, right? It depends on the recipient countries and depends on whether other countries see China as a threat. And I think in a lot of cases, although China has been able to use its political influence and use especially its economic influence and the financial resources to make sure that other countries will not say so. But if you go deep down into the societies, for example, in Southeast Asia, and you look into the civil society's view of China, I think the view has been, well, at best mixed, at worst very hostile and very negative.
Anthony Kuhn, what's Beijing's view on this? Are they a benefactor? Have they make no secret that they're about China's interests and moving out is also about making sure that China's population, nearly 20% of the world's population, has what it needs, and so it looks for resources around the world?
Sure, that's certainly one of its arguments, that it drives global growth. It accounts for about a third of the world's economic growth, and that by pulling out of, it's the biggest contributor to poverty alleviation anywhere in the world. So, it considers that a public good in itself. I think it sees the provision of infrastructure as truthfully, very much needed. And it's true. If you look at a lot of the countries where it's building this Belt and Road, series of ports and highways and trains, think of countries like, Indonesia, which are growing at like 5% a year. They could be growing at 7% a year if they had decent roads and railways and stuff. So some people say, the U.S. has got to compete with China on this infrastructure building stuff. Well, really, it's all just a drop in the bucket. So much infrastructure is needed around the world. There's really not that room for that, not that much need for competition. And in fact, if you look at the, you know, the lending institutions, China has its Asian investment infrastructure investment bank, and then you have other multilateral lending institutions. They're actually cooperating on building infrastructure in these places. So from that perspective, what China is providing is needed.
But does China go in, let me ask this to you, Derek or Anthony, does China go into these places, provide the infrastructure, and then take over areas for their own use? I'm thinking of Sri Lanka's Hambantota port turned over to the Chinese in December, despite public protests. A lot of times China goes into these projects and takes a controlling share and then gets a foothold in a strategic area around the world. Is there some sort of a strategic move that China's trying to make? Anthony, let's go to you first.
Yes. Well, a study just came out last month by a Washington, D.C.-based think tank called the Center for Global Development, and they said there are quite a few countries. They named eight countries that are at serious risk of debt crises because of China's lending for Belt and Road projects. Countries like Laos, Mongolia, Pakistan, Djibouti. You know, for these countries to pay China back the loans, to service the loans, is going to take up a lot of these governments' revenues, and either that could trigger a debt default and an economic meltdown, or it could cause them to actually lose sovereignty. They might have to you know, give away or lease chunks of land. And yes, that has happened in countries. You mentioned Sri Lanka, the port of Hambantota, and there are several of these ports, including Djibouti, Pakistan, where there are concerns that China, having gotten control of these ports and facilities, could use them as strategic stepping stones for their military.
Derek?
Yeah, I mean, the Belt and Road right now is at 71 countries, and it will probably expand. There are kind of jokes about how the Arctic will be part of the Belt and Road, then the moon, and so on. I don't think we should see the whole Belt and Road, the whole Chinese outreach, as strategic. And even when there's debt involved, I don't think we should see it as strategic. For example, the problem, the country with the biggest debt problems that's clearly connected to Chinese financing is Venezuela. The Chinese are not looking to take away Venezuelan sovereignty. They've just wasted a lot of money on Venezuela because Venezuela has seen its economy horribly mismanaged. So you can see debt and you can see Chinese involvement without a strategic element. Nonetheless, within that group of 71 and growing countries, there are certain countries, and Anthony just named several of them, where there is a strategic point, where there are ports on the Indian Ocean or in choke points in Southeast Asia, as in Malaysia, where you can see the Chinese thinking strategically, not just economically. So we have two kinds of challenges here from China. One is we're the only ones providing infrastructure to a lot of these countries, so we naturally have influence over them because we're their best friends, and that's a large group of countries. Then there's a smaller group of countries where the Chinese are clearly looking for strategic advantage, and so far the United States and its allies have not been able to respond effectively.
Last week, of course, China met surprisingly with North Korea's leader, Kim Jong-un. It really came out of the blue for many people. Shortly after that meeting, China's foreign ministry spokesman, Liu Kong, told reporters that she said North Korea is working to improve East Asian relations.
General Secretary Xi Jinping spoke highly that important efforts made by the North Korean side are improving the Korean Peninsula issue. We are open to helpful suggestions to work for the denuclearization, as well as peace, stability, and the long-term peace of the region and the whole world.
Yoon Sun, what do you think China and North Korea were hoping to accomplish by that meeting? And of course, it comes before Kim is supposed to meet with the South Korean leader and with President Trump.
Well, from the Chinese perspective, the top priority, of course, is to prevent or to preempt any attempt to exclude China from the North Korean nuclear issue moving forward. When the announcement of Trump accepting an invitation by Kim Jong-un to have a bilateral meeting, to have a summit, came out on March 8th, China was not involved in that process because that invitation was delivered by the South Korean special envoy, and President Trump just accepted that invitation without consultation with anyone or with any party. So the speculation for the majority of March was that China no longer maintains a central position or central role in this North Korea nuclear issue. And then the further speculation is whether China will be a bystander moving from now on. And of course, from the Chinese perspective, to lose its leverage or strategic leverage, a piece of bargaining chip vis-a-vis the United States on the issue of North Korea is highly undesirable. And I think, so from the Chinese perspective, through the visit between Kim Jong-un and Xi Jinping, what China wants to accomplish is to show the world that China would not be excluded. China is a gateway to Pyongyang. And for anyone to want to even dream of excluding China from the process, they can stop dreaming. But from the North Korean perspective, there are also several messages that the North Koreans send. First of all, is that saying the North Koreans want to prepare for a scenario where the summit between Kim Jong-un and President Trump doesn't go well. And the appointment of John Bolton as a national security advisor, at least in China and among some of the Korean scholars, were speculated to be a President Trump making the plan for a military option in case the diplomatic option does not work out. So I think the North Koreans also want to show the world that China is still a strong supporter of North Korea. So even if the bilateral meeting with President Trump doesn't go well, it does not necessarily give the U.S. the opportunity to just attack North Korea. During the meeting between Xi Jinping and Kim Jong-un, they also discussed a lot about their domestic politics and domestic economic development. So I suspect that we are going to see some improvement or warming of economic ties between China and North Korea. If the engagement approach does work, meaning that North Korea does take on a path of denuclearization even gradually, I think it will open some opportunities or possibilities for such economic ties between North Korea and the rest of the world to improve.
Thank you, Yoon. I just want to get Anthony Kuhn in quickly. Anthony, how did that visit play out in Beijing?
Well, at first it was completely denied. There was a hilarious scene at the foreign ministry with a spokeswoman saying, you know, we know nothing about this. But then we saw the pictures. It was really a sumptuous thing. There was this, armored train which the North Korean leaders rode into Beijing. And as I said, there was this really retro communist talk. The old way of putting it was that China and North Korea are close as lips and teeth. Now, they didn't use that phrase, but they were clearly harking back to that sort of language. And as we've discussed, that was a reminder to folks that these are, you know, there's solidarity here and, they're going to help each other out.
Anthony Kuhn, NPR's Beijing correspondent, thank you so much for joining us. Yoon Sun.
You're welcome.
Yoon Sun, who directs the China program at the Stimson Center, so glad to have you with us.
Thank you.
And Derek Scissors, chief economist of China Beige Book, which also focuses on China's economy for the American Enterprise Institute. We appreciate your time.
No problem.
I'm Jennifer Glass. This is On Point.